I've come to Holden Village this summer from St. Olaf College in Northfield, Minnesota, where I teach in the religion department and in the para college. I'm a church historian, and my primary interests within that discipline tend to fall variously as three topics: America, church, and women overlap with each other, and they've done that in various ways in my career as a student and a teacher. This week they fall together in a particular way in that we'll look at five American religious women. But before we turn to that, let me say a few things about the theme for the summer at Holden and how I think this series of five sessions will fit into that theme. The theme, as you're probably aware, as treasure in earthen vessels, embracing the contraries. I was delighted when I heard that was the theme, because that sort of motif of earthen vessels and in a mirror darkly, that already but not yetness of the Christian life is a part of it that always seems to me very realistic and very appealing and very strong. As that theme applies to this series of five sessions, the treasure that we're concerned about is the gift of faith. The gift of faith that comes to us as a gift from God, and the gift of faith that comes to us from the mighty cloud of witnesses that is around us, both the living and the dead. And indeed, it is the vessel, the earthen vessel that I'm looking at is the witness of those who have come before us. So that part of the way we receive the gift of faith is through the vessel of persons made of earth that God has breathed life into in the past and whose life goes on to give us more life. The contraries, I think, are in the long title of this series that you probably haven't heard. The long title I gave to this session is Blessed Are They Who Have Faith. And it comes from Luke. Let me just read you a couple verses from Luke 11, 27 to 28. As Jesus said this, a woman in the crowd raised her voice and said to him, "Blessed is the womb that bore you and the breast that gave you suck." But he said, "Blessed rather are those who hear the word of God and keep it." So the contrary that I'm playing with a little bit here is the fact that not just up to Jesus' time, but frequently in the 20 centuries that have followed, women have been told by our culture and by our church that the way we are blessed is by reproducing and by making children who become godly. I have a friend who studied convent schools, and she discovered that the best thing, you know, the really good thing you did if you were a student in a convent school is become a nun. But the second best thing was to leave the convent and go away and have a family and have sons who become priests. Okay, and so the thing that I want to look at all of us together this week are the examples of some women who are blessed not because of their wombs and their breasts giving suck in the literal sense, but because of the way they have had faith and have been obedient to God's word. So there's this funny little saying that follows us around about biology or anatomy being destiny. What we're looking at this week is not biology or anatomy being destiny, but what Louise Tappa, a theologian from Cameroon, has said: our spiritual commitment is our destiny. Okay, so we'll have five sessions, and I've written the names of the five women that we'll look at up here. And we've been reminded in the last couple days that although these people are my friends and my heroines, they aren't all familiar to you. You can't get pictures of them in bubblegum. So just a little preview if you're trying to decide which days to come and which days not to come. Today we'll look at Lucretia Mott, a 19th century Quaker preacher who was involved in the anti-slavery movement, the women's rights movement, as founder of Swarthmore College, who was involved in all of those reform movements of the 19th century. Amanda Berry Smith, this really active in the second half of the 19th century, was a black holiness preacher. And one of the things that I find particularly interesting about Amanda Berry Smith is that the geographical scope of her work. She was not only in the United States, but also in England, Scotland, India, and Sierra Leone and Liberia. Then the third figure is Vida Scudder, whose career, active career, was really in the first third of this century. She taught English at Wellesley College, but she's also interesting in that she anticipated the Christian Marxist dialogue that comes in the 60s and 70s. She's very interested in socialism and the labor movement, as well as being a faithful Episcopalian churchwoman and developing an interest in Franciscan spirituality late in her life. Dorothy Day is probably familiar to many of you, the founder of the Catholic Worker Movement. And then Polly Murray, who died only in 1985, a black woman from North Carolina who was one of the first women to go to Howard Law School. She was a civil rights lawyer and was late in her life ordained as an Episcopalian priest. So quite a span. We have about one per generation from the early 19th century till the present. What I hope that we'll do, what these five women will enable us to do, is, first of all, to learn about them individually, who they were, what they did, how they thought, what they said. And you should have around on the sheets, around on the chairs, two blue sheets that we'll use today. I do have to ask that you give those back, because I'm doing the same session again in 2 weeks, and I only brought enough for once. If you're really going to use it, you can take it. But if you're just going to go home and forget about it, please give it back to me. Okay. But I don't want us just to learn about these women. I hope that we will consider how they can serve for us as models of lives of faith, being people of the church. And for me, this is a particular concern. It seems to me that frequently what happens as people become radicalized, whether that's through feminism or through some other kind of social awareness, that we leave the church and we look for our models outside of the church. And one of my special concerns is to look back into our history and find the people who take responsibility for the church and who are nurtured by the church. A theologian from Ghana, Mercy Oduyoye, I think is how you pronounce her name, has said about African women, something that I think applies also to these five women, that they have in them the ability not only to adapt for the purpose of survival, but to be creative beings linked with the Creator God. And in that way, I think these five women who we'll look at together this week can serve for models to all people of faith, that they're not limited by the fact that they are women, to be models for women. And toward that end, I've suggested three questions you might keep in mind as we go through each woman's life. First of all, what about this woman is attractive to you? And secondly, what is troublesome? Because I don't think you'll find each of them equally attractive. And then finally, what would you like to emulate about this woman? How can she really serve for you as a model? Okay. Then just a few words about bibliography. I've given you up here two real general bibliographic references. The first, and these two are both available in the bookstore, is Her Story, Women in Christian Tradition by Barbara McAfee. This is the result of 25 years of work. She's really drawn together all the specific research that's been going on in the last 25 years since the SCIES did, and has wonderful bibliographies. So if you're looking for an overview of the history of women in Christianity, this is really a good resource. The other one I put up there because on the biographical sheet they asked for our publications, and so the bookstore has a ton of these, and I want them to sell them. I'm not getting any more cut or anything. And that's my book, From Our Mother's Arms, which is a history of women in the American Lutheran Church and its antecedents. It's this lovely pink color. Okay. Then let's turn to Lucretia Mott. I've given you here three bibliographic references for Mott. These are not available in the bookstore, but if you're sufficiently interested, you want to follow up. The first is a biography by Margaret Hope Bacon called Valiant Friend. And the second, Mothers of Feminism, by the same author, is this one, The Story of Quaker Women in America. And if you should happen to pick this up, you'll be, I think, surprised to discover how many of the influential women in the early women's rights movement came out of the Quaker tradition. And then the third is this compilation of Lucretia Mott's complete speeches and sermons, which is from Mellon Press. Okay. Lucretia Mott. Those of you who have the handout see her picture. She was a woman of the 19th century. And I think it's worth saying something about 19th century America, and particularly religion in the first half of the 19th century, to understand why Lucretia Mott did things that she did and why she was really very remarkable in her time period. The early half of the 19th century was marked by a period of revivalism. We call it the Second Great Awakening, the First Great Awakening coming before the American Revolution. And that shaped American religion to a large degree. It gave people a sense not only that their own lives needed to be converted, which is what happened at a revival, but also that their holiness, their desire for holiness, should push them out to reform society. So we have many social reform movements in this period. And a lot of those are carried out by people who took part in the revivalist movement or the Second Great Awakening. But another stream going into those reform movements is the Society of Friends, or the Quakers. Primary tenet of the Quakers and the Society of Friends is the inner light, that each of us has an inner light of divine light within us. And that's the basis of all their concern about equity between different kinds of people, between white people and black people and men and women. In the early years of the United States, Quakers were illegal. If you've ever been in Boston, you may have seen the statue of Mary Dyer, who was hanged on Boston Common because she was a Quaker. By the early 1800s, it was no longer dangerous to be a Quaker. And Quakers were giving leadership, particularly in the abolitionist movement. Other issues that they took up were women's rights and peace. The role of women in 19th century religion was an expanding one. Particularly Finneyite revivalism had the view that everyone's voice should be heard. And so one of the new measures of the Finneyites was that women were praying out loud in public. Some people found this very, very bad and unsettling that women should pray out loud in public. But they did it. And they also prayed in small groups leading up to revivals, so that we see women functioning both as evangelists and as the evangelized. Among the Society of Friends, that was not so radical. From the very beginning, there had been female preachers in the Society of Friends, and Lucretia Mott was one of those. However, we should not think that this expanding role for women came easily. It was an issue. And people were, some women had rocks thrown at them, and letters were written about how awful it was that women would testify. They weren't yet preaching, but they were testifying to their own experience. Lucretia Mott was born in 1793 on Nantucket Island, just off of the coast of Massachusetts. Nantucket was a stronghold of the Society of Friends, and particularly groups that people who were involved in whaling. So this, the doctrines of the society, which gave equity to men and women spiritually, were combined with a social situation in which the men were frequently gone for long periods of time. Lucretia Mott's father was once lost at sea, was gone for over 3 years, and they weren't sure if he was ever coming back. This, as you might expect, contributed to a very hardy and self-reliant group of women from whom Lucretia Mott sprang. Her daughter described these women, let's see if I can find this quotation, saying, look at these women, look at their heads. They can mingle with men. They are not triflers. They have intelligent subjects of conversation. And for in large degree, they were merchants. After her father came back from that 3 years of being lost, he decided to take up a new career. And they moved, they moved inland to Boston. Lucretia was sent off to school at Nine Partners, which was a school run by the Society of Friends. And it had almost equitable education for boys and girls. And then she was asked to come there as a teacher. That was one of her own first experiences of a kind of discrimination, because the female teachers were paid significantly less than the male teachers. It was at Nine Partners that she met her future husband, James Mott. Her family name was Coffin. And they were married in the early 1800s. James Mott was a quiet man of strong conviction. And I'm convinced that he's very important for our understanding of Lucretia Mott, that as is her whole extended family. Each of these women, I'm going to suggest for them a kind of tag or label to describe them, not womb and breasts, but something else. And I think for Lucretia Mott, we might call her a practical prophet or a household prophet. And this is because her family provided a strong support structure for her. Early in their marriage, the Motts had 6 children. 5 survived infancy. During the time that her children were small, Lucretia rigged up a way that she could nurse and read. And so she read all the classics of the Quaker writers, William Penn, the founders, Margaret Fell, and this served her very well later in her life when she became a public preacher and was involved in some controversies. And so then she could point back to the authorities of her tradition. In 1818, she made her entry into the public ministry. Now, what that means is somewhat different in the Quaker tradition than it is in the more mainline Protestant traditions. It simply means that she offered public prayer in meeting. Okay. And quickly, those in her meeting realized that she had a gift for preaching, and she was given leave to travel, which she did widely, to preach to other meetings, and was respected as an elder and a wise woman. she and James both became involved in abolition, the anti-slavery campaign. And they did that in a variety of ways. Perhaps closest to home, they did it by boycott of slave goods, which was not an uncommon abolitionist strategy. So they made candies that didn't use sugar, and they wrapped them in papers with little anti-slavery slogans. They didn't use cotton in their clothing, and in fact, for James, that was a major economic decision because he had been a cotton merchant, and he switched to a different, I think he started then dealing in wool rather than in cotton. They were both active in the organizations, which the early 19th century is just, there are hundreds of organizations, and they were active in the formation of the American Anti-Slavery Association, which initially did not include women. So Lucretia was not initially a member of that. Consequently, she went out and organized the Philadelphia Female Anti-Slavery Association and gave speeches. Occasionally, they were involved in the Underground Railroad, but for the most part, the Motts were more concerned about addressing the systemic issues than in individual actions. Certainly, they were very careful about how they spent their money, and they used their money very often for charitable projects. But I'm always astonished when I realize that they really were interested in justice and they saw the systemic problems. Okay. Initially, they were somewhat tempted by the strategy of the colonists. It was a strategy to free slaves and send them to Africa. And that's where Liberia came from. It was a settlement of freed slaves. And it was William Lloyd Garrison who convinced them that that wasn't the right strategy. As Lucretia went about lecturing, she had one experience that I think is foreshadowing of other issues she would be involved in. At one point, she was lecturing with a man about anti-slavery, and the audience was less than receptive. They decided they would tar and feather her companion. And she went to them and said, "Please don't give me any special treatment because of my sex." And on another occasion, she did a similar thing, offering herself on behalf of an elderly woman she was traveling with, and then the people dispersed. So we also see very practically in Lucretia Mott's life a kind of what we would call non-resistance that was very effective for her. In 1840, the Motts were sent to London for the World Anti-Slavery Convention. Now, at that time, there were two parties of anti-slavery forces in the United States, one of which was involved in women's rights and one of which was not. And Lucretia Mott, of course, was a delegate for the group that was. When she got to London, the London Committee would not seat her. So it's as if, you know, the real delegates are down here and those of you who are up there are just sort of watching. And she had to sit up there with the people who were just watching. Her partner next to her, who had not come as a delegate but who had come on her honeymoon trip with her husband, was Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was then a young woman. Mott, by this time, was 47. And that was the beginning of a long partnership between those two women. It was 8 years later when Mott was visiting her sister in upstate New York, Martha Coffin Wright, and Elizabeth Cady Stanton was invited for tea one afternoon, that they decided to call the first Women's Rights Convention that then took place July 19th of 1848. And that really launched the formal women's rights campaign in the U.S. As you can see, Mott lived significant number of years after the Civil War. And in those years that followed, she often had the task of mediator. She tried to mediate between her old abolitionist allies who said, now is the black man's hour, and the white women should step away and let us secure voting rights for black men. It's not your turn now. Wait. She tried to mediate between them and the women's rights advocates, who had also been involved in abolition. There was a strong partnership between those two groups. She also tried to mediate between the two parts of the women's rights movement, the part that wanted to focus on suffrage as a clear goal that you could work toward, and the ones who wanted to keep things larger. She expanded her concerns out. She was one of the founders of Swarthmore College, was very interested in education. And the Mott household continued to be a gathering place for the reformist community. Lucretia Mott was known, for example, for her blueberry pies and for the fact that she loved to get up early in the morning and nail rugs. I guess they had rag rugs, and they stretched them and nailed these carpets down. And she took great pride in how tight and straight her rugs were. Those things went on. They moved out what then was outside of Philadelphia to a place that you had to take a public wagon to. But the wagon wouldn't carry black people, and so Lucretia always walked. So there was a consistency to her life that I find very appealing and very inspiring. She saw the connections between all these different kinds of issues, and she was always motivated to act on those issues because of her belief that there was an inner light, a divine inner light in all people. Well, let's look then at just briefly at some of the things from her speech or her sermon, One Standard of Goodness and Truth. Now, I should say something about this. It was the Quaker tradition to speak extemporaneously. Lucretia Mott did not write down her speeches either before or after she delivered them. And so all that we have are on the basis of stenographic records. Okay. And actually, this volume is very recent. 9 years ago, when I was working on my master's thesis, you couldn't get them except in manuscript form. So, okay. Let's look on the back, not the page that has her picture on it, but on the opposite page. Are there extras around? I see not everyone has them. In this sermon, Mott is arguing that what is right is one, and that everyone should be able to discern what is right. The first full paragraph on that page begins, "Many people have become so inured to slavery." Someone have a nice loud voice who could read this? Mary, would you mind reading? Just there's two paragraphs, so it ends up being about a total of a column. Then we might look at the last page, and in the next to the last column, where Mott says, "The more we are disposed to enter this reforming theater of the world, the greater will be the promise of improvement of the social system, and the nearer the approach to the true end of human existence. There is much to be done. If we have entire faith in the efficacy of right doing, we shall find strength for it. What is needed is confidence in the possibility of coming into the kingdom now. A great deal of time and effort has been spent in the sphere of poetic fancy, picturing the glory and joy of a kingdom hereafter. But what is chiefly required of us is to come into the divine government now, and to be pure even as God is pure." then skipping a paragraph. It is essential that we have faith in uprightness, in justice, love, and truth, for these are among the highest evidences of true Christianity. I care not for charges of verbal infidelity. The infidelity I should dread is to be faithless to the right, to moral principle, to the divine impulses of the soul, to a confidence in the possible realization of the millennium now. We know that what we are at present. If we are doing right, acting in accordance with the sacred principles, we all know how peaceful and happy we are. And we know how we are brought into torment by violating the right. We should have the assurance that if we resolve to do right, we can do it. Those are themes that run through Mott's work. She consistently dismissed the doctrine of human depravity. She has a very high anthropology. If you can think of the right, you can do the right. She tends to have a low Christology. She thinks of Jesus primarily in terms of being a moral teacher and an example, and that comes in part from her being influenced by Elias Hicks. You see a brief quotation by him, the very last lines there, to the Christ that was never crucified, to the Christ that was never slain, to the Christ that cannot die, I commend you with my own soul. She really placed authority in truth, and she has this slogan, truth for authority, not authority for truth. So there's a sort of subjectivity to what she does, but also a real consistency and a willingness to be taught. So having introduced you to Mott, let me entertain questions either of information about her, the things she did, the way she thought, and also invite you to respond about the things that you find appealing or the things that are disturbing to you about this woman who is our forebearer in faith. She didn't have a lot as a child. Of course, on Nantucket, which was all Quaker, there weren't slaves. As a young woman, after she was married, she did make a brief journey below the Mason-Dixon line, preaching in meetings. But I think her antipathy to slavery was out of principle as much as out of seeing the evil itself. And the Quakers were among the earliest to see that. Some of them, for example, objected to slavery because they were told not to accept booty of war. And they understood slavery to be the result of war, and that then that's what they were benefiting from war, and they were pacifists and they couldn't benefit from war. And then there was also this thing about the inner light. And the inner light was in those slaves, whether they were Christians or not. That wasn't an issue for Quakers, as it was for some of the evangelical Protestants, that if you didn't baptize slaves, then it was okay to have them as slaves because they weren't Christians. You know. And then there were others who thought, well, the way to justify slavery is we bring these people here and then we preach the gospel to them, and so they're so much better off now being slaves who are Christian than they were in Africa, because then they weren't Christians, you know, and they were going to be damned. And within their logic, that makes really good sense. You know, in our logic, it doesn't make as good sense. She was, you know, an adolescent. I don't know what they did in Nantucket. I would guess it was some kind of community school. Her husband died. Let's see, I have it here. Well, by the time he died, she was pretty old. He died in 68, and then she lived another 12 years. She kept right on up till the end. And she was one of the things that I think is an ironic tragedy is that she was so revered by the women's rights people of her age, and nobody knows about her. When she died, they went to her grave and they just stood there and said, "What will we do?" And the first time the Equal Rights Amendment was introduced, it was called the Lucretia Mott Amendment. I have a couple theories about why that happened. One is because she didn't write. And it's the sad truth that if you don't leave written records, you're easier to forget. And the other four people we're going to look at all wrote autobiographies, which makes them more accessible. We have to kind of guess about some things about Lucretia Mott. I think another reason is because she did so many things that her activity was really diffused, and that makes her easier to forget. Someone like Elizabeth Cady Stanton, who was really flashy and very loud, made a bigger impression. And the Grimke sisters, Sarah and Angelina Grimke, who have been revivified, particularly after Gerda Lerner's biography of them. Well, they're just, they're so fascinating because they come from this slaveholding family in South Carolina, and then they come north and they become abolitionists, and then they were Quakers, and Angelina marries out of meeting, and so they were thrown out of the Quaker fellowship, and then they go off and run a school for the transcendentalists, and they get in this diet where you boil all your food on Saturday and then you just eat it cold all week, and they're really kind of more colorful in a way. And here you have little Lucretia Mott with her gray Quaker dress, who's just plugging away. And I think, unfortunately, although that may be a better model for us, she's easier to forget about. Unless, of course, you know me, and then you hear about her all the time. I've never seen, and Jerry was just asking me the other day if she was related to James Mott, the big ecumenicalist, and I haven't ever seen any connection. She has this one sister who was involved in the women's rights movement, and I think in the second, the next generation there was some, but I haven't seen anyone trace it further.
Do you have any sense for the way in which she worked with or related to blacks in the abolitionist movement? I recently read Vincent Harding's book, There Is a River.
Yeah.
And he strongly asserts that whites were so much in control of the direction of that. And I wonder if there's any...
She was friends with Frederick Douglass and the Fortrum sisters, who were in Philadelphia. They were guests in her home. I can't say that she was less inclined to control than any other white abolitionist in the time period, but I do think she had things like that she wouldn't ride on the wagon suggests to me that she realized that slavery wasn't the whole problem, and that it was the relationships between people that were out of whack. It wasn't just slavery that was the problem. That's one of the kinds of things that it's hard to get at because we don't have any personal papers from her. There's just this tiny diary that she kept when she went to London, which is mostly dashes. It's really frustrating. You think, where did she go to school? Didn't she learn about sentences? So that's hard to know. One of her contemporaries, Prudence Crandall, was a Quaker who kept school, I think, in Connecticut. And she... admitted black children to her school and just defied the whole town. In fact, they've kept trying to get rid of her, and they wouldn't send their kids there anymore. So there is a Quaker approach that, in my reading, tends to be, think it's cooperative, okay? Whether or not the blacks who, the white people thought they were cooperating with experienced it as cooperation. That I don't know. Are there things about Mott that you find difficult? Sometimes when I talk about Mott, people go, oh God, superwoman. She did everything. And that's when I come back to how important I think it was that her family was supportive. James Mott presided at the meetings at Seneca Falls because none of the women felt like they could do that. So he was the one who acted as the moderator, and then Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Lucretia Mott were the main ones who spoke. And Mott traveled, James traveled with Lucretia all the time. Yeah, and she has written, some of these addresses are about marriage, and she has a little, again, a kind of motto that I always give with the wedding presents about in the marriage, do I have it written down? I'm not sure I know it by heart. But about the obligations being mutual, and it's a very equitable thing. But that was, again, that's the Society of Friends. So that if you look at Lucretia Mott in the huge context of American religion, she seems really unusual. But in the Society of Friends, she wasn't so unusual. The things that she got in trouble with Quakers is that she was associating with non-Quakers, not that she was preaching. That was expected. And that's another thing to be said about her, that she had not only family support, but at least in large degree support from her community. Not entirely, but that allowed her to have what I think is so important, a sense that she's responsible. And that's why I would suggest that she's a householder. And that's also that we see more in the late 19th century, women reformers saying, okay, fine, if the home is my sphere, I'm going to make the home bigger. And education, if I'm supposed to be in charge of children, education then is something I'm supposed to be concerned about. If I'm supposed to be concerned about the morality of my family, then I have to be concerned about anti-prostitution. And really with Mott, you see that she feels responsible for the whole world, just like she felt responsible for her own family. And so you don't get any tone in her work that this is for her, but rather that it's her job, or her job is maybe a word that has possibility of being interpreted negatively, but that it is her calling to take responsibility for what goes on around her and to show what is right and to move forward in progress. Now, one of the things that can be troubling about Mott is that she's a 19th century person and she thinks everybody's making progress and that we're getting somewhere. And that comes also out of her denial of human depravity, which is one of the things I find real troubling about her. Because I don't know then what you do with evil and when things don't work. I think she was a particularly busy woman. Her school friends called her Spitfire. Now, I don't know if that means she wasn't humble, but she obviously had a lot of energy. I don't think she had time. So,
I have just a couple of comments. Because you started out by saying that the treasure that you're presenting is their faith. And I think it's particularly exciting to see her faith was so put into action, and it definitely spilled out outside of her house into the political realm, looking and viewing the world and seeing it at work. And then I think, you know, I'm trying to think of something troublesome. And I think the most troublesome thing would be to elevate what she says and put it right into a contemporary society. And I think of her little analogy with people walking by and seeing a woman with a thimble on her finger just being awestruck at that awful sin that was transpiring.
Which she herself got in trouble for.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But I think doing needlework on Sunday. That have been taking place in the last couple of weeks with our Supreme Court, and that so many of those things go unnoticed, and yet we come to the flag and it becomes a huge thimble on our finger. And so it could be real troublesome to simply look at what you said back then and present it to what's going on.
Yeah, and realize that a century and a half hasn't seen as much progress as she thought there should be. And Sue, as you point out, that she's an activist. She goes outside of her own sphere, her own home. I've also been impressed that she learned Quakers weren't really interested in voting and politics. Wasn't something they cared about. Wasn't something they were involved in. And so initially, like at Seneca Falls, she didn't care about women's suffrage because she didn't think voting was important. It wasn't that she didn't think women should vote. But people like Elizabeth Cady Stanton and Susan B. Anthony convinced her that that was important. And then she changed and was willing to go on. And you can see that happening in her life, that she grows with her situations. She's an activist contextually with what the problem is now. Okay, thank you. Tomorrow we'll look at Amanda Berry Smith. And as I said, if you're not going to keep these blue sheets, please give them back for the people next week.